Hey everybody, Johnny B. Truant with the Badass Project, here today with Sean Baptiste, and
nice.
That's Sean over there, and this is a really cool one, because Sean's mission, his project, is kind of similar to ours in a way. In, I mean, we're going to get into that in a second, but let me just ask you, rather than me trying to expound on your story and what led you to do what you're doing, can you sort of take me through the basics of it?
Yeah, so for the past several years, I've been or had been the manager of community development for Harmonix Music Systems, the video game company that made like Rock Band, and I would go around the country and show it off to famous people and show it off to the fans, and
thanks for that, by the way. Thanks for Rock
Band. Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. No, it's It was great, you know, just flying around, going from place to place, and visiting fans and meeting people I never thought I'd get a chance to meet in my entire life, and, you know, playing a video game that I really love. And, you know, before I even started in the industry, I had been diagnosed with a brain tumor, and the brain tumor is inoperable. It's not growing, but it's inoperable. Mm-hmm. But it's... in a place that completely blocks it from fluid getting out of my brain, which gives me hydrocephalus. So my head just keeps filling up with liquid, and then my brain gets squished, and it causes a lot of pain, and, you know, it's not fun at all. So they put a shunt in my head that, you know, that's like a straw that goes all the way down into my brain, into the very, very center part of my brain, sucks out the cerebral spinal fluid, and then deposits it in my abdomen. And I first got that in 2004. Mm-hmm. And it pretty much was okay. I had to have it replaced in 2005, but that went really smoothly, and I recovered really quickly. And then in late 2009, in December, I had to get it replaced again, because my ventricles, the shunt was actually working too well and had collapsed my ventricles, which was... just as bad as having them overfilled. So they had to put in a new shunt, and when they put in the new shunt, we thought everything was going to be okay. I felt fine. But then they said there was an infection, and they'd have to go in again. And then, so we did that, and then that failed. The shunt failed shortly thereafter. So basically, between December of 2009... and May of 2010, I had about 12 operations on or in my brain that kind of left me with some neurological, sort of like brain trauma, mm-hmm. for the most part, which left me, it's hard for me, my memory doesn't work so well. Sometimes it's hard to recall words and everything. Right now, I'm probably at the best I'm going to be all day, because... you know, I didn't wake up too long ago, and I took my pills, and it's early in the day. So, but as the day goes on, it becomes harder and harder. And then sometimes I have this problem where I slip into what my doctors call dissociative sleep, which is where I'm awake, but then my brain goes to sleep while I'm still, like, doing something, like either watching TV. Once it happened while I was cooking, which is dangerous. So my whole body, and I keep doing things, but I'm kind of my brain is actually in a dream state. And I don't remember any of this happening, and I only find out about it the next day when my girlfriend tells me how scary it is.
Oh, whoa.
But yeah, I become a completely zombie-like different person.
Is it kind of like sleepwalking? It's kind of like if you run into a sleepwalker and they're just kind of out there?
Yeah, except you can actually talk to me and I'll respond, mm-hmm. but I won't necessarily mm-hmm. respond with anything that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And my eyes will be open the entire time. Mm-hmm. So it's this really weird sort of thing. But it's required me to make sure that I, you know, go to bed at like 9 every single night. So, a lot of the stuff that I used to like to do, like go hang out with friends or go see shows or whatever, I just can't do anymore, because I can't be in really loud places, and because I get too, my brain gets too distracted, and I can't process anything. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where I am medically.
Okay.
For the most part.
What's your prognosis going forward, Sean? If I don't know if I could ask.
Well, I'm just trying to rehab my brain pretty much as much as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. I try to stress it to the limits. It's really hard for me going out, and even if I have some friends over, it can make me totally mentally exhausted in, you know, half an hour to 45 minutes. I can be drifting off. I call it white noise, where I can't pay attention anymore. It's like my brain is rebooting. And then I can jump back into the conversation later, but I just keep, and I get exhausted and I can't do it. So that's been really, really difficult. But at the same time, I feel like every time I do go into that, or, you know, stress my brain like that, it's like working out. Mm-hmm. And I might be exhausted from it, but it's probably a good thing ultimately. So hopefully, I mean, I don't necessarily think I'm going to be the same as I was before all the operations. Mm-hmm. I don't really think that's a thing that's going to happen, but I'm hoping, I'm learning a lot of tricks and everything about how to get my head to work a little bit better, work differently, but compensate, that I'll be able to do some of the stuff that I used to do before.
You know, I'm sort of curious. This makes me think of, you'll hear every once in a while about, I don't know if you've heard this stuff. I remember hearing stories about people that they would discover. I actually have a friend like this, and his dad was in a car accident. And so they did a CT scan just in case. He was fine, but they just did it just to make sure that he didn't have a concussion.
Yeah.
And what they discovered was that he had basically, they say, virtually no brain. He just basically had, like, a little bit of brain matter inside of his skull and a stem. But he's a vet. You know, he's a veterinarian. He's a very educated
guy.
And I've heard cases like that where basically, I guess, I don't know if this is just theory or if they have anything to prove it, where they say that people's brains have learned to rewire themselves and work with what's essentially there. And I'm wondering if you've run across any of that or...
That's what I'm trying to do. Like, I've learned that my visual memory is something that still works better than, you know, verbal memory or anything like that. Like, remembering a conversation I had with somebody is very, very difficult. I'll actually tell you a story later when we're talking about the show, something that happened that was totally nuts. But but visually I can come up with stuff. So what I do now to sort of test myself is my girlfriend will tell me to go to the store and buy, you know, like four items. And I call it Bob Rossing it, because I paint a picture in my head that's totally ridiculous. Like a visual painting in my head that I can remember of the four things I'm supposed to get, but in the weirdest, like, anthropomorphized, you know, maybe it's like, I think one of the ones I did is I had to buy butter, milk, doggy poo bags, and like Fantastic, like the spray.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it like a senior prom. And the butter and the creamer were dancing together, and then the Fantastic and the poo bags were off in the corner sitting there, and because they weren't dairy, so they were sort of good. Right. But I could have this whole thing, and it made me laugh, and it could make me remember it. And the more ridiculous and more frankly, sometimes the dirtier you can make them, mm-hmm. the better you can remember them. And this is an age-old trick, I guess, that even like Plato and mm-hmm. all of the ancient antiquarian sort of guys, mnemonics, that's how they would remember things, is creating these visuals and these memory palaces. So I've been using that to compensate, but still that doesn't help during a conversation because mm-hmm. I can't catalog things fast enough.
That's really interesting because I was, when you were describing that, did you ever read the book Hannibal? It was the...
Yes. When they told me about mm-hmm. the memory palace stuff, the first thing I said was, oh yeah, I've heard of that. That was in the book Hannibal.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what I thought.
Yeah.
So, and I know that there are all sorts of tricks like that. Like at one point I got on a memory kick and I wanted to be able to, I don't know, memorize a stack of cards in order.
Yeah.
And they have different things where you can attach different phonic sounds to visual objects and stuff. That's really... So have you started exploring all that stuff?
It's kind of interesting. Yeah, I've started looking at, like, the stuff that would work for me with the parts of my brain that would work to compensate for the parts of my brain that don't work so well. And so, yeah, I've been using some of those tricks with my cognitive therapist, as well as, you know, the big rehab that we did was the show, that When I Grow Up.
Okay, well, so let's get into that. So tell me, how did that start? How did the When I Grow Up, how did that start?
When I woke up from the last surgery I had, which was in May of last year, I woke up in the post-op just from, you know, coming out of anesthesia, when they have you in a closet with a whole bunch of towels in there and you're next to a whole bunch of other people trying to wake up. And, I always put it like this. The first thing I thought was, oh my God, I really need some ice chips right now. Because when you come out of anesthesia, and I had to be intubated. So, you know, your throat is so dry and rough and, so I always want ice chips, so I call a nurse over, and I was chowing down on ice chips, and it was right then I had this whole, like, fully envisioned idea just popped into my head while I was coming down off of the anesthesia, and I was like, what ever happened to all those things I wanted to do when I was a kid, like all those jobs I wanted to do, everything, you know, that... When I was a kid, I was so excited about it, and I just wanted to learn about all of it, and that's what I wanted to be for the rest of my life. And then I wondered why nobody ever goes back and tries to do those. And then I was like, what if I try to do that? And at the time, we didn't realize how bad my brain had been sort of hurt, how much sort of trauma I'd undergone, and that there were sort of lasting neurological things, but I was like, what if I did that? That'd be a fun project. So I was telling a few people, and I told a friend of mine who I had done some video work with and some film work with in the past, Trevor Chamberlain, and he was like, we should totally do that and just, like, do one of the jobs and just film that. And I was like, yeah, that's an excellent idea. That'd be fun. So we decided that the first one, the thing that I wanted to be probably most when I was a kid, was a stand-up comedian. I loved stand-up comedy when I was a kid. It was like the biggest thing. That's what I wanted to be. But I never ended up pursuing it. So I got a trainer who actually trains people to be stand-up comedians, Dana J. Bine, who's a comedian himself. And I went to some classes, and then I got some private sessions, and I was learning how to become a stand-up comedian, and all the while, I can't remember things. Like, reading something and then trying to remember what I just read, or trying to remember it the way an actor remembers it. And I used to do a lot of acting. It just didn't work anymore. I couldn't memorize what I had, but by the same token, it seemed to me that it would be total failure if I went up there with note cards. Because that would prove nothing. Right. That would prove nothing to me at all. And I would much rather try to prove something and fail than not even try it the way it really should have been done. So, I went through all of these things. I was working with my cognitive therapist to find ways to use it. And I just ended up using three different parts of my memory to hide it in basically every part of my brain. So when I got up on stage, there'd be no way to forget it. Once I got going, I wouldn't be able to forget anything. So first I did it the traditional way that an actor does it. Like, you read it and then you try to remember, you try to read, say it back without looking. And then you look back and you keep doing it the way, you know, actors do. And then what I did was that worked not too well. So then I just recorded myself reading it. And when I would take my dogs outside, I would just listen to it on a constant loop of me doing it over and over again. So it would go into my, like, auditory memory.
Right.
And then the other thing I would do is I would listen to it and try to transcribe it by hand in a notebook at the same time, and then flip over the page and try to write out the thing without hearing it or looking at it. Just try to write it out. And that would go, you know, into a completely different part of your brain for memory. These are all, like, you know, just trying to hide it in as many different places as possible. And it ended up working. At least initially, I was able to get through things fairly okay. And it actually, I mean, going through that process taught me so many things about how my brain works. And we learned a lot of things about what works and what doesn't by going through the whole process.
So which one worked? Do you know which one worked, which approach?
For me, I think listening to it on a constant loop helped a little bit because it just reinforced it. But I think the thing that helped the most was transcribing, because that actually visually you're looking at the words as you're writing them out, and they're imprinting in a different part of your brain. It happens, and that's not uncommon. There's lots of students that they've said you do better on your tests if you take notes. Because it's not that you go back and read the notes, it's that the act of taking notes imprints things better into your brain, into long-term memory. So that's what we tried, and I think that worked the best.
So this is a really interesting discussion in sort of cognitive psychology and so forth, because I remember hearing experiments where with split-brain patients where the corpus callosum between the two halves of the brain had been cut, and it's like, I don't, maybe you know these and you can help me out, but I think it was something like if they looked at it with one eye, they couldn't identify it, but if they touched it with the other hand, they could, or something like that.
Yes. Yeah, I've read a bunch of reports like that. Yeah, if the right brain and left brain actually can't speak to one another, some very interesting things can happen.
Or they can verbalize it. They can't verbalize it, but they can identify it on a visually on a sheet or something like that.
Yeah, and some people actually their personalities change 100% and they become entirely different people than they were before. Some people I've seen who've had brain trauma have come out of it speaking an accent.
Really?
That they've never like spoken in before. It's just this weird things get triggered. It happened to me. Like I had temporary stuff that was. One thing was I couldn't look up because they had injured the nerve that controls just the upward movement of my eyes. So I could look left, right, down, all that, but up was just impossible. And I thought I was lying. Like the entire time I was talking to the doctors, I thought I was lying, or I thought somehow psychosomatically I was doing this to myself. And they were like, no, that actually makes sense. And then they explained it, and that made me feel a little bit better. And that it was temporary, that made me feel a little bit better too. And then I had another thing where and they never figured this one out, but just unconsciously, my upper lip would just start twitching up for no reason. And I looked totally disgusted at whatever people were saying, just randomly. And it ended up being one of the neurological tics that I got after the, I call them mutant powers. That I got after surgery, that I was kind of sad to see go because it made conversations really funny when you were talking to people.
So how long was your comedy set?
It was, well, depends. I've done it twice, or I did it twice. I've actually since then done it a few more times. But for the show, I did it twice. I did it first at an open mic, which I've got to tell you about in a second.
Okay.
That was, and then I did it at a real showcase. And the one that I did at the open mic, I think, was a little over 10 minutes long. And I think the one I did at the showcase was around 7 or 8 minutes, I would say. A little bit shorter.
Did people know that you had memory issues and so forth? You just go out there blind?
Well, the funny thing was at the open mic, the film crew had asked for permission to film at this bar in Waltham, and for an open mic, and they asked the bar owner, but they also asked the comedian who ran it, and then this game of telephone sort of happened, that it went around until eventually one of my friends, who was also in the comedy community, called me on my cell phone, and I answered. He was like, Sean, are you doing a gig at the Gaff tonight at the open mic? And I was like, yeah, how'd you know that? It's supposed to be kind of a secret. He was like, everybody in comedy is talking about how there's some sick kid playing at the Gaff tonight, and it's like a Make-A-Wish thing or something right. like that. And which totally wasn't the truth, but it did pack the place in because a whole bunch of people showed up to see this potentially, you know, sick kid do a comedy set for Make-A-Wish Foundation, which wasn't the case, but it was very funny. But the thing is, that entire night, mm-hmm. I don't remember one thing that happened, really. Mm-hmm. I don't remember doing my set. I don't remember any of it. Talking to my cognitive therapist, what she thinks is that I was trying so hard to remember mm-hmm. that my brain's entire processor speed was going just to trying to recall mm-hmm. and trying to perform, so that there was nothing left to imprint things from short-term memory of working memory mm-hmm. of what's going on to long-term memory. So that was crazy. That the next morning, I was like, I had to ask my girlfriend if what had happened the previous night.
Well, you've got the visual record now. You got the video, right?
Yeah, I immediately asked the director if he could send over some video because I didn't remember any of it. And he kind of thought I was joking. And then I was like, no, seriously, I really don't remember even really going to Waltham last night. So
that might work for you, though, because then if you have a bad night,
you could just forget about it.
Right,
yeah.
You'd be discouraged. So how did you do? Was it a good set? Did people respond well?
People responded well, and my girlfriend and the crew and some other people gave me really good feedback, and they thought it was really funny and that I had done really well. But then when I watched the video, I was really angry with myself because but now I can't blame it because I was like, well, I don't remember doing this, which means I was clearly not probably in the right condition to be doing it in the first place. But I felt like I was going too slow. Mm-hmm. So it gave off the impression sort of, I thought that I came off drunk maybe. And that's not how I wanted to come off. So,
If it makes you feel any better, I talked to Josh Blue, the guy who won Last Comic Standing, and for the project, his interview's on here, and he's got bit about when he got picked up by the drunk tank, because he said he's 24 hours later, they're wondering how much did this guy drink. So there you go. Maybe you got that thing going too. So I want to ask you about some of the other things that you've done and are going to do for this show, but I just want to step back. So you said that this was as you were coming out of surgery and you were in recovery. Was it sort of one of those things where, like, people say that they have a traumatic experience, or they have one of those things where they realize that life is short and that's what prompted it? I mean, was there a tie between where you were and why you decided to do this?
I mean, I think so. I don't know, not consciously, really. It certainly later on became more of an imperative for me to do this as mm-hmm. I learned kind of how much trauma had happened and kind of like how bad of a position I was in. So as we found out more of that stuff and the stuff that wasn't recovering the way we thought it was, it became more and more important to me to prove to myself, more than anybody else, but prove to myself that I could still do stuff, that I'd still be able to pull off stuff that I shouldn't be able to pull off. And after doing the stand-up comedy episode, it's just made me hungry to do stuff that's even harder and more complicated. And it's not really about succeeding or failing. Mm-hmm. I imagine there's a whole bunch of them that off of the list of things that I would be totally bad at, that I would fail at, that I wouldn't be able to do. But it's about trying and about, you know, if you set goals and you fail at them, that's fine. At least you set goals and you tried. And that's how I try to live each day. So, you know, when I woke up from the show, I didn't know any of this was going to happen. But I can't say that my brain didn't know that any of this was going to happen. Some of that might have been, it might have been like, yeah, you should really start thinking about how short life can be and try to do some of this stuff. Because I already had a really great job. It's not like I was doing this because, I already had kind of the dream kids job. But I wanted to try out this other stuff too.
probably giving you brain exercise too, I would imagine.
It is. They my cognitive therapist and has I talked this all over with her before I did any of it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we agreed that this is probably some of the best rehab I could give myself, because it would really be stressing me, all the parts of my brain that were injured, and require me to really compensate for that.
So what other jobs that you wanted to do when you were a kid have you done, and are you planning to do?
Well, we've only done the stand-up comedy so far. We're hoping, you know, a lot of people see this and maybe it gets picked up. So as a real show, mm-hmm. Either online or on a network. And we're actively working to try to make that happen. But some of the other stuff that were, you know, the other jobs I want to try. One episode that I think would be amazing is when I was a kid, there was this rap group that I listened to constantly. And I'm not going to say their name right now. I'm going to save that.
Right.
But I've since sort of like talked to them a bunch of times and sort of kind of become friendly with them in the past like year or 2 years. So they even sent me a T-shirt when I was in the hospital. So I had that up and took a bunch of pictures. But I'm hoping to get them and have them teach me, because then it's like, the reason why I wanted to be a rapper when I was a kid was these guys, and then have these guys actually teach me how to rap. I don't know if I would be good at it. I don't. I doubt it. But I think it would be a very entertaining episode.
Yeah, I want to know who that is. I would imagine that's even harder than comedy, because you gotta do it fast.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, that's gonna be. I mean, but I'm wondering if it might be easier for me to remember things if it goes along to music. Because I know that helps people a lot of times, is if music is part of it, that it's a little bit easier to remember. I'm not sure if that would work for me, but I'm hoping.
They say with stutterers that can work. If you
yes.
stutter, that if you kind of remember and sing and so forth, that it can work?
Yeah, it takes a little bit of the pressure off, because mm-hmm. the music is carrying some of the weight. One of the other episodes we wanted to do was, that I really wanted to do is like every kid, I wanted to be the president.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing we were trying to figure out is how do we do that? Like, who would train me to be president? And, you know, it's not like Obama probably has the time to just sit down with me and be like, okay, this is how it works. So I was thinking about, what about presidents in some third world countries that have really turned things around for their respective countries? And one of those countries I was looking at was Botswana, mm-hmm. which has actually done really, really well. And then actually Barbados has this incredible history of what they have done financially and what they asked the president asked the people of the country to do, so that they could get back on track. And now they're a developing financial powerhouse as far as the Caribbean goes. So yeah, that like something like that I think would be amazing, finding out from these people who really, really changed things for the better for mm-hmm. everybody in their country, what that's like, and learn from them.
So what about attitude question? I mean, you have this disability with memory, which is sort of a thing that is something that a lot of us just take for granted, that we can remember things and process and so forth. But you're almost kind of joking about it. Is that
yeah.
always been kind of your attitude, that it's you certainly don't seem to consider it as something that's going to bum you out? I mean, I'm sure it does.
No,
but.
Well, I mean, it does. There's times where I get really low. I call it when I have a bad roommate in my head.
Uh-huh.
You know, like the roommate who's always like down on you and be like, oh, you're never going to get better, but, you know, whatever. And, you know, mm-hmm. the one that tries to bring you down, that voice in your head that tries to bring you down sometimes. And, you know, sometimes it gets to me. But for the most part, I'm a really optimistic person. And, you know, part of that was that part of what I think helped me was realizing that I might not, and accepting that I might not be how I was before. But that doesn't mean that I'm not going to be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, being like, you know, just find a new way to be awesome, or find a way to compensate for what doesn't work and be awesome. And, you know, my whole thing has been to set goals for myself every single day and then try to achieve them. And, you know, at the end of the day, I've done something. I write a blog, 3 times a week. Barron Barometer is the website. And, that, so I've been trying to do that and get information out and talk to people about what it's like to recover from, traumatic brain injuries. But then, you know, I've also, one of the other projects I took on is trying to write 1,666 words every day, in novel form. And I got about close to 20,000 words, and then I got really sick and I wasn't able to do anything. But I'm hoping to get back into it and jump back into it, doing it every day. But then the idea is that at the end of the month, you have a 50,000 word novel.
And I was going to wonder if you started that in November, perchance.
No, well, NaNoWriMo.
Yes, that's what
does take place in November. Yeah. I was doing it more just as, again, just a weird cognitive rehab thing that I talked to my therapist about, and she was like, "Yeah, go for it."
Mm-hmm.
So I just decided that would be probably one of the hardest things I could do, and I mean, I did kind of fail at it because I got too sick to be able to even. This was like 2 weekends ago. I couldn't leave my bed, so just crippling headaches. So that did kind of get affected, but I'm hoping to pick it up again. And then maybe if I do really well, maybe I'll try it in November during the official NaNoWriMo month.
It seems like a lot of the people, pretty much everybody that I've talked to, has this attitude of sort of analyze and adapt. So here's what I can do, here's what I can't do, and how can I maximize what I can do? And the way that John Morrow put it, who was our first interview and sort of the reason I started this, is, okay, so if you've heard that one, he said everybody's disabled.
Yep.
It's just that we have a different, you know, like the way I say it, I'm disabled with car repair. Like, forget, you know, I can never do that. And there are people who can. And it's your condition with the brain. It's a very specific and like demonstrable example of that, where you have to sort of find new paths. So it's really interesting.
That's been my whole thing, has been like, well, if I can't do it the way I used to do it, how do I do it? And then not be like, well, now I can't do it.
Right.
It's just like, well, find a way to do it. Like, figure out a way to do it. Figure out a way to make this happen. What do you have to do? And, you know, really think about that. Because I don't ever want to consider myself as not being able to do something anymore because of this. And, you know, in a lot of ways, a lot of positive stuff has come out of this. I think, you know, I've become, in my head, certainly, and probably personality-wise, a lot more driven to take the projects that I think about or come up with and then really try to make them reality, really try to make them part of my rehab, really try to make it work, really try to make it goal-oriented, and constantly trying to take a step forward every day. And I've been better at just completing things, I think, than I was before, because I don't think I had the I can't remember the word.
Well, you're establishing proof for yourself. I mean, when you once you've you know, become a comedian, and once you've become the president or whatever it is, these things that you're doing, then completing a task, I would imagine, is going to seem pretty paltry by comparison.
Well, that's what I keep thinking is, and I actually wrote this in one of my blog posts recently. I said that the reason why I make all of these goals for myself is so that I can achieve them every day, so that the next time if this happens, I mean, because I'm going to have to go in for more surgeries at some point, they're going to have to replace the shunt at some point, and this could all happen again, is that so when I go in, I don't, you know, I think one of the guys that you introduced recently, you know, is that, like, you know, otherwise he would have taken 100 Vicodin and just, you know, ended it.
Mm-hmm.
I can, you know, go into the hospital, have this happen again, and just be like, okay, this is another challenge. What are my goals? And actually make a game of it for myself, you know, and make it not scary anymore. Make it fun. Make it a job. Make it work. Make it cool. Make it awesome.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, this has been very, very cool, Sean. I hope everybody you know, good luck on the show. It's a
thank
fantastic,
you very much.
It's whenigrowupshow.com, correct?
Yes. Yep.
And your blog is baronbarometer.com.
That's the one, yeah.
And it's very cool stuff. I love the adaptation aspect of it all. It's just very concrete in a way that we haven't honestly seen before. And it's very cool. And thanks for being on. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So, everybody, this is Johnny B. Truon here today with Sean Baptiste for The Badass Project.